Hello and welcome to the Did You Hear podcast, part of KPFA's Area 941 podcast series. I'm Max Pringle. On today's show, he was a man of humble beginnings who became a giant of American statesmanship in the 19th century. As one of the leaders of the radical Republicans in Congress in the mid-1800s, Thaddeus Stevens helped push the abolitionist cause to the forefront in the hurly-burly of Civil War-era politics. His dogged pursuit of full equality for the formerly enslaved and Reconstruction-era America helped to get the 13th and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution passed, which would formally end slavery and grant citizenship rights to African Americans. After his death, he was derided for nearly a century in American popular culture and scholarship as obstinate and punitive toward the South. But his rightful reputation as an early champion of a true interracial democracy would be restored during the Civil Rights Movement. He's now the subject of a terrific new biography by historian Bruce Levine, professor emeritus of history at the University of Illinois, and author of Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary, Fighter for Racial Justice. Bruce Levine joined me recently via Zencastr to discuss his new book. I started by asking him if the Vermont of the late 18th century, which Stevens was born into, had a strong abolitionist tradition at the time.
An abolitionist society formed in his hometown of Peacham. And in general, Vermont as a whole was a pioneer in expressing anti-slavery sentiments. It was the first state in the Union to denounce slavery in its state constitution. He was also born into a family of Baptists, and the New England Baptists were also particularly democratic-minded, small d, and also particularly favorable to the struggle against slavery. His own family was very committed to the most democratic document produced by the American Revolution, which is to say, the Declaration of Independence. And so on multiple fronts, Stevens was exposed to and embraced hostility to slavery.
Let's talk a little bit about Thaddeus Stevens' mother. I think his father left the scene pretty early in his life, and that left them in poverty. How was his early life with his mother and his siblings, the early struggles they had to go through?
Well, Sarah Morrill Stevens worked very hard to try to support her family in the absence of a husband. Parenthetically, we really don't know what happened to Joshua Stevens. There are all sorts of stories about that, but we don't know the truth. And the Stevens family was further faced with problems in that two of its four sons were disabled by problems with their feet, which limited the amount of farm labor they could do. So she fairly early picked up and moved in with her brother to try to find a way to make the family viable. That was also one of the reasons, if not the primary reason, why she pushed Stevens toward a life in the professions, pretty sure that manual labor was not going to be his forte, and taking note of the fact that he was a very precocious boy.
Now, did that disability, Thaddeus Stevens' club foot, do you think that played into maybe his sympathies with other marginalized and sort of looked down on people?
Many people who've written about Stevens say so, and I certainly wouldn't rule it out. I can imagine that it might be true. Incidentally, I can also imagine why it might have fostered the kind of biting, sarcastic retorts of which he became very famous when under attack himself. But Stevens himself did not refer to that disability as the reason for identifying with the downtrodden. He cited instead his family's struggle with poverty and expressed appreciation relatively early in his adult life for not having been born into a well-to-do family, saying that their poverty, his family's poverty, is what disposed him toward empathy with others in similar circumstances and worse.
So Thaddeus Stevens' mother did stress education, and that motivated him, and he eventually went off to Dartmouth University. Was he exposed to a lot of abolitionist ideas studying there?
Yes, apparently so. He went both to Dartmouth and for 1 year. The reason is unclear. Once again, he went to the University of Vermont. And the students at the University of Vermont were already debating the rights and wrongs of slavery in formal debate clubs by the time he arrived. And the books that he was assigned included strong denunciations of slavery from the point of view of free labor, what we would call capitalist economy.
And on that note, when he leaves university, he becomes a pretty shrewd businessman in his own right and an investor. And he also, as you said, champions this idea of free labor ideology. Talk a little bit more about that free labor movement in the early 19th century.
Well, the North and the South are moving along diametrically opposed, although intertwined, economic paths. The North is fostering at an early stage the growth of, again, what we would call capitalism, and what they more commonly referred to as free labor society, in which individuals were legally free, free at least before the law, to choose their own employers or to go into business for themselves. The champions of that system prized it for what they saw as the ability of all individuals, particularly men, of course, to make choices about their own lives, and if they worked hard, to move out of the status of employee and become an employer in their own right. And from the point of view of those values, the legal ownership of one human being by another was economically backward and morally wrong, morally reprehensible. And so the growth of that kind of economy in the North fostered opposition to slavery.
Now, Stevens would go on and move to Pennsylvania to further his career. And it's there that he turns to politics and early on, and he's elected to the state legislature. Talk about his early political career and how that gets off the ground.
Well, he originally winds up running successfully for relatively small, low-level, local public office. Eventually, as you say, moves on to repeated terms in the Pennsylvania legislature, and initially does so as a member of what in retrospect looks like a rather odd and obscure political party, the Anti-Mason Party, which was a relatively short-lived political party dedicated to combating what they saw as the threat to political democracy and free labor by the Masons, which were then a secret society of people pledged to support only other Masons above all others in all walks of life, both economic, social, and political. So from the point of view of its opponents, the Masons represented a cabal that could indeed undermine the functioning of a republic and free choice of economic opportunities. That was a very successful party. It really drove the Masons back from a level of political influence that they had previously attained. But that success basically spelled the doom of the Anti-Masonic Party, which no longer had a purpose. At which point, Stevens joined the Whig Party, which shared with the Anti-Masons a commitment to the growth of northern capitalism with the aid of government support. And in the Whig Party, Stevens continued his struggle to win government support for economic development in the North. And he also fought for restrictions on the expansion of slavery, to the point that in 1850, when a major struggle between North and South threatened to disrupt the Union 10 years before Lincoln's election, a compromise was worked out in Congress, known, of course, as the Compromise of 1850. Abraham Lincoln, incidentally, who was by then a former member of the Illinois legislature, heartily endorsed that compromise. Thaddeus Stevens, a member of the legislature in Pennsylvania, I beg your pardon, by that point, he is a member of the House of Representatives, as a Whig representative, vigorously denounces and refuses to support that compromise because the compromise allows slavery to spread and it makes it easier for Southern slave owners to recapture human beings who had managed to escape from the South into free states in the North, makes it easier for the slave owners to recapture them and drag them back into slavery. That leads to Stevens' isolation in the Whig Party, and eventually to his joining in the middle of 1850s, the brand new and expressly anti-slavery Republican Party.
And that early Republican Party was also a kind of a coalition of not necessarily competing interests, but interests that had some goals in common, including the ending of slavery. Is that right?
Well, yes. There, as in most, if not all, political parties, there was a political spectrum even within the Republican Party, stretching from its more or less conservative-minded leaders to its most radical leaders. And what distinguished the conservatives from the radicals was the degree to which they were determined to put an end to slavery as soon as possible. All members of the Republican Party were committed to preventing the spread of slavery into present and any future federal territories. And it was also hoped that doing that alone would help to strangle slavery in the states where it already existed, because almost everyone in the country believed that slavery needed to expand in order to survive, sort of like the way sharks need to keep moving in order to breathe. So by preventing its expansion, it was hoped slavery would die a natural death even where it already existed. But there were increasingly sharp differences within the Republican Party about how consistently, how energetically to pursue that plan, and those differences increased once the Civil War began.
Bruce Levine is our guest. His latest book is Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary, Fighter for Racial Justice. Bruce Levine, what was Stevens' relationship with some of the major abolitionist figures of the mid-19th century? I'm talking about the Frederick Douglasses and William Lloyd Garrisons and stuff.
Well, he did not have a great deal of personal contact, from what I can gather, with the major figures of that movement, neither Douglas nor Garrison. He did have contact with and correspondence with, and in some cases, personal meetings with anti-slavery members of first the Whig and then the Republican Party, and people like Salmon Chase of Ohio, Charles Sumner of Massachusetts, and others. And by the way, with Abraham Lincoln, who was more moderate than Stevens was. In fact, at one point, Stevens, in an uncharacteristically nervous, cautious moment during the post-war era, expresses in private some concern about how publicly identified Frederick Douglass is being with the cause of Reconstruction and the Republican Party, fearing, probably correctly, that that would aggravate the sensibilities of anti-slavery, but nonetheless racist Northerners who might take offense at that. But in general, Stevens worked very closely with abolitionists, including a Protestant minister with whom he had regular contact and whose anti-slavery activities Stevens vigorously endorsed, and worked with them in the Underground Railroad. In his own home in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, became a station in the Underground Railroad.
Now, for more than a century, Thaddeus Stevens, in popular culture and scholarship, has been sort of looked on and vilified as this kind of a vindictive and obstinate zealot. Talk a little bit about that that early portrayal of Stevens.
Well, to understand that portrayal, I think we need to understand what's happening politically in the country, starting as early as in the 1870s. The North, and especially the Northern business elite, had been drawn into the struggle against slave owners during the Civil War, primarily in order to keep the Union intact and to keep, therefore, the Republic intact, but also to keep a national market intact, which was of great importance to Northern merchants and especially manufacturers. Once they had managed to defeat the secessionist movement and had managed also to obtain the kind of control over the federal government that had eluded them for decades before the Civil War, the Northern elite began to lose interest in the cause of anti-slavery and especially the cause of fighting the restoration of white supremacy in the South, and began to retreat from those causes. And in the process, as they basically abandoned the revolution that had given them supremacy in the country, as they turned their back on it, they began to retrospectively vilify the most radical advocates of those causes, who now appeared to them primarily as dangerous extremists, because dangerous extremists were precisely what became uppermost in their fears as they consolidated their own economic system and faced critics and opponents among various sectors of the Northern population, including small farmers and wage earners. Well, as this process occurs, a parallel process takes place in academia and culture. And so, for example, by the end of the century, academia, North and South, the writing of professional history, is in the hands of people with basically the same conservative point of view, who look back upon Reconstruction with disdain, precisely because of its radicalism. They would much rather make peace with the South in order to restore good feelings and good economic relations. And so Thaddeus Stevens can only appear to them to be a villain, just as indeed he had appeared to conservatives in his own day. And the writers of not only academic history, but also popular history, take their cue from such views. And Thaddeus Stevens is presented the same way in books written for a broader public. And then when the motion picture industry takes off, we see the same kind of thing happening in representations of Thaddeus Stevens, either by name in movies about that era or in thinly disguised symbolic representations of Thaddeus Stevens. And one film after another, one book after another, including, by the way, John F. Kennedy's famous book, Profiles in Courage, which comes out in 1955, which sings the praises of Andrew Johnson, the enemy of Reconstruction, and pours scorn upon Thaddeus Stevens in rather brutal and even vicious terms. And that was probably something that John Kennedy had learned at Harvard, because that was how Harvard was teaching the history of that period. It's not till the Civil Rights Movement makes its mark on American culture and academia that that negative view of Stevens begins to be revised.
Now, Bruce Levine, you touched on this a little bit earlier in your remarks. Stevens supported Abraham Lincoln, and I think they respected each other, but they differed strongly on some major questions, like, for example, how to prosecute the Civil War and what to do with the South post-war. Tell me a little bit about that relationship.
Well, that's exactly right, Max. Abraham Lincoln hated slavery. I don't think there can be any doubt about that. Hated it in all respects, not least of all morally, and wanted to see it disappear as soon as possible. But he also believed that there were severe restrictions on what he could and should do to bring that about. This becomes especially clear when the war begins. Lincoln, like many others, believed that Southern population as a whole had been tricked, maneuvered into seceding from the Union, tricked or outmaneuvered into seceding from the Union by a small group of pro-slavery zealots, and from that premise proceeded to the idea that the South could be brought back into the Union more or less speedily if, while prosecuting the war, the North would do as little as possible to chafe Southern white sensibilities. And that in turn meant interfering with slavery during the war as little as was absolutely possible. So Lincoln wanted to be very limited in what he did about slavery during the war, and said so early in his term. Thaddeus Stevens, like Frederick Douglass and other radical members of the Republican Party and abolitionists, vigorously opposed that, not only on moral grounds, but on practical grounds. On practical grounds, they argued that you can't win this war without attacking slavery vigorously and across the board, because slavery is not only the mainstay of Southern society, it is a crucial source of support for the Confederate war effort. It is slaves who grow the food that feeds the Confederate armies. It's slaves that drive the wagons that brings supplies to many of the Confederate armies. And the only way to defeat those armies is to deprive them of this crucial source of labor. Morally, Thaddeus Stevens believed that the war gives the North the opportunity constitutionally, or better to say legally, to do what the Constitution had prevented it from doing before the war broke out, which was to treat the South as what it was now calling itself, an independent country out from under the protection of the federal Constitution, and use that fact, acknowledge that fact, and use that fact to attack slavery root and branch. And he continues to make that argument consistently, virtually from the first day of the Civil War, and aided by the objective logic of the situation that the Union finds itself in, he manages to bring the Republican Party toward most of the things he's advocating, including not only emancipation, but also the induction of African American men into what had then, until then, been lily white armies.
And when I was reading this portion of your book, I was kind of struck by a parallel, and I'll get your take on this, Bruce Levine, that it seemed that, you know, in World War II, for example, the Allied war aim was to defeat fascism, as you said, root and branch, that after the war is over, we're going to have to completely destroy this structure of governance, tear it out by the roots and rebuild. Could you say that there were some parallels here of how the radical Republicans wanted to rebuild the South?
Well, I think that's right. But I think, once again, there are differences within the U.S. government during and preceding and after the Second World War on that score, just as there were within the U.S. government during the Civil War. I don't think the U.S. government went to war against Germany to uproot fascism. Fascism was by then many years old, and all of the brutality that we identify with fascism was manifest long before the United States got into the war. I think the United States primarily got into the war because the fascist government of Germany, like the authoritarian government of Japan and that of Italy, were threatening its interests in the same way that many northern residents in 1860-61 opposed the South, not because of moral issues, because they sympathized with the slaves, but because they saw the South stepping on their interests, stepping on their toes, and undermining what they needed to see done in the country and the continent as a whole. But once the war gets underway, it becomes difficult to separate the struggle against fascism from the struggle against German, Italian, and Japanese expansion. And the most anti-fascist figures and forces in the United States want to pursue this, again, root and branch during and after the war. But as I imagine you also know, other segments of the United States government were also bringing various Nazis, including scientists, into the United States, despite their political identities, in order to help them fight communism after the Second World War. And to a certain degree, the United States began turning a blind eye toward the political backgrounds of a number of German politicians and Austrian politicians as well, for precisely that reason, because these people seemed useful to them. In the post-Civil War United States, a struggle similarly breaks out between conservative Republicans and radical Republicans about how consistently to pursue the revolution begun during the Civil War.
Let's talk about that post-war period of radical Reconstruction, Bruce Levine. There was we had the nation's first ever impeachment process go through with Andrew Johnson, and he was taken on by the radical Republicans. Let's talk about that period.
Well, when Abraham Lincoln is assassinated, the man who steps into the presidency is, of course, Andrew Johnson of Tennessee. Johnson was a former slaveholder, but he was a Tennessean who kept his seat in the United States Senate when his state declared itself out of the Union. And he supported the war to restore the Union and thereby endeared himself to the Republican Party, which is why he was placed on the ticket in 1864. As a way, it was hoped, to attract other similar Southern whites who might look upon his presence on the ticket with favor. It was not, of course, anticipated that he would rise to the presidency, but when he did so, he before very long began to use his power to restore the old slaveholding elite to at least a measure of its control once again over society and politics in the South. And under his benign supervision, the Southern states were brought back into the Union. Their right of self-government was speedily restored, which rights they used to fill their state legislatures and some of their governor's mansions with leading figures in the Confederacy. They also used the legislatures to begin passing racist laws that deprived former slaves of key rights that white people had always taken for granted. Rights designed to keep black people subordinated to whites and to keep them in the position of a more or less helpless labor force at the disposal of whites. Throughout this, Johnson shielded those efforts and apologized for those efforts. And when Congress, controlled by the rest of the Republican Party, moved to impose stricter controls over the South to try to nullify those anti black laws and to try to make sure that the South became safe for African Americans and for those whites who had been loyal to the Union during the war, Johnson again used his power to undermine Congress's efforts. Congress, for example, put a series of generals in ultimate charge of the rights of African Americans and loyal whites in the South. Andrew Johnson, one after another, removed them from power and replaced them with more malleable figures who were far less committed to equality than were the generals he removed. He finally did the same thing with his own Secretary of War, who was increasingly allied with the radical wing of the Republican Party. At this point, many Republicans, Thaddeus Stevens in the lead, decides that Andrew Johnson has to be removed from office if the gains of the Civil War are going to be retained, are going to be kept, are going to be cemented in place, and if the revolution begun during the Civil War is going to be able to continue to unfold in the years afterward. And so the House of Representatives does indeed vote to impeach Andrew Johnson. Thaddeus Stevens is among those drawing up the articles of impeachment. He's one of the House's managers of the impeachment case in the Senate. And finally, when the case comes to a vote, Johnson avoids conviction by one vote, a vote by one of the more conservative members of the Republican Party, who refuses to go along with Stevens' effort to remove Johnson.
And sadly, the Reconstruction program would be abandoned for the better part of the next century. But Thaddeus Stevens did live to see some major achievements like the 13th and 14th Amendments, didn't he?
Yes, he sure did. He was absolutely key in getting the 13th Amendment passed. He was incidentally calling for that amendment a year before Abraham Lincoln signed on to the project. By the way, something you'd never know from Steven Spielberg's movie about Lincoln. And the 14th Amendment was something else that Stevens fought very hard to achieve. He was also calling for, indeed demanding, that the Republican Party and its representatives in Congress go further than that and adopt what eventually comes into existence through the 15th Amendment. A better guarantee of African-American voting rights, but he actually dies before that can be achieved. He's nonetheless a principal and vocal mover behind that effort until his death.
Now, as we've seen over the past year, we know that the business of creating a true multiracial democracy is still ongoing, but what can Americans of today learn from studying the life of a great champion of equality like Thaddeus Stevens?
Well, I think they can learn that someone whose ideas frequently seem fringe, extremist, too radical for his own time, can, under the right circumstances and with a certain set of skills, begin to persuade his fellow citizens of the rightness of what he or she is advocating. And that is really the story of Thaddeus Stevens' success. One thing after another that he begins calling for, this is especially but not solely true during the Civil War and Reconstruction, appears at first unacceptable to the large majority of people around him, but over the course of time, with skillful argument and ability to build a movement in support of what he's calling for, he is able to achieve things that seem initially absolutely impossible to accomplish. And I think that ought to give inspiration to people today fighting what often seems like an uphill battle for the rights, among other things, of African Americans and members of other national minorities, and for that matter, women.
And that is the voice of Bruce Levine. He's Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Illinois, and author most recently of Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary and Fighter for Racial Justice. And it's been good enough to join us today. Bruce, thanks so much.
Thank you, Max. Really enjoyed being with you.
And that's it for this edition of the Did You Hear podcast. Did You Hear is part of KPFA's Area 941 podcast series and is available to listen to at our website, kpfa.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.